I'm Paul Kennedy. Welcome to Ideas. All this week, the 2009 CBC Massey Lectures, The Wayfinders, Why Ancient Wisdom Matters in the Modern World, by Wade Davis. The CBC Massey Lectures began in 1961, and over the years, these broadcasts have become a place where the best minds of our time discuss the issues that face us, both as Canadians and as citizens of the world. The three partners in this great enterprise are CBC Radio, Massey College in the University of Toronto, and House of Anansi Press, publisher of the book of the lectures. In earlier years, the Masseys were recorded in a radio studio, but 7 years ago, we took the lectures out of the studio and onto the road, so the lectures you're hearing this week were all recorded in front of a live audience, this year in Yellowknife, Vancouver, Halifax, Montreal, and Toronto. The 2009 CBC Massey lecturer is anthropologist, filmmaker, and writer Wade Davis, whose curiosity and researches have ranged from zombies in Haiti to sacred plants in South America. Among many books, he's the author of The Serpent and the Rainbow, which was made into a movie, and One River, nominated for the Governor General's Award. I'm drawn to the story of Polynesia, says Wade Davis, because it reveals so much about the issues and misconceptions that both inspire and haunt us to this day. The sheer courage that true exploration implies, the brilliance of human adaptation, the dark impact of conquest and colonialism. From the Chan Center at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, here's Wade Davis with The Wayfinders, the second of the 2009 CBC Massey Lectures.
I don't think there's anyone in this audience who's not family or friend, so it's a wonderful homecoming, and thank you all for coming out. Let's slip for a moment into the largest culture sphere ever brought into being by the human imagination, Polynesia. 25 million square kilometers, nearly a fifth of the surface of the planet, tens of thousands of islands flung like jewels upon the southern sea. Some months ago, I was fortunate to join a good friend of mine, Nainoa Thompson, and the Polynesian Voyaging Society on a training mission on board the Hokulea, a beautiful and iconic vessel named after Arcturus, the sacred star of Hawaii. A replica of the great seafaring canoes of ancient Polynesia, the Hokulea is a double-hulled, open-decked catamaran, 62 feet long, 19 feet wide, lashed together by some 8 kilometers of rope, with a fully loaded displacement of 24,000 pounds. First launched in 1975, the Hokulea has since crisscrossed the Pacific, visiting over the course of over 150,000 kilometers every island group of the Polynesian Triangle, from Hawaii to Tahiti, to the Cook Islands and beyond to New Zealand, east to the Marquesas, and south and east to Rapa Nui, Easter Island. Even more distant voyages have taken the craft to the coast of Alaska and the shores of Japan. The Hokulea carries a crew of 10, including captain and wayfinder, two very distinct roles. On board is not a single modern navigational aid, save a radio, only to be used in case of dire emergency. There is no sextant, no compass, no depth gauge, no GPS, no transponder. There are only the multiple senses of the navigator, the knowledge of the crew, and the pride, authority, and power of an entire people reborn. When European sailors first entered the Pacific in the 16th century, they encountered a new planet. Among the Spaniards, it was not Cortez, but Vasco Núñez de Balboa, who first stood silent upon a peak in Darien, and with eagle eyes stared with wild surmise upon an ocean so vast it dwarfed the Western Islands, Homer's realms of gold, and all the goodly states and kingdoms seen. The poet John Keats, writing 2 centuries later, imagined with awe what the first Spaniards must have felt. Ferdinand Magellan in 1520 took 38 days to round the Horn, the southern tip of South America. With half his men dead, he slipped into a void he took to be a peaceful sea. He sailed on, and in 4 months upon the water, with sailors dying by the day, he managed to miss every populated island in the Pacific. Finally, on April 7th, 1521, he landed on the island of Cebu in what is now the Philippines. Magellan was a brave man, ruthless in many ways, but also stubborn. In his desperation and blindness, he had, by circumstance, bypassed an entire civilization that might have taught him a great deal indeed about the open water. The first sustained contact between Polynesians and the Spanish occurred 3 generations later, when in 1595, Alvaro de Mendaña de Niera followed the easterly trades and came upon an archipelago of 10 volcanic islands rising as sentinels out of the equatorial sea. Even before making landfall, he named the islands the Marquesas, after his patron, the Marquis of Cañete, Viceroy of Peru. These islands comprise the most isolated island group in the world, and yet at the time were home to as many as 300,000 people who knew their islands as Te Henua, Te Enata, the land of men. It was an extraordinary meeting of civilizations. The Marquesans considered their islands to be the end of the world, the last stop on a mythical journey that had carried their ancestors along wind and waves from the west. Every human being was a descendant of Tiki, the first human, and each clan could trace its genealogical history to the primordial diaspora that had come out of the setting sun. Beyond the horizon to the east were the lands of the afterworld, where spirits departed the body and plunged into the sea. Thus, to the Marquesans, the Spaniards were as demons, embodiments of depravity born beyond the far reaches of the eastern sky. Carnal and deceitful, cruel beyond reason, the Spaniards offered nothing. They had no skills, no food or women, no knowledge of even the most fundamental elements of the natural world. Their wealth lay only in what they possessed, curious metal objects that were not without interest, but they had no understanding that true wealth was found in prestige, and that status could only be conferred upon one capable of acquiring social debts and distributing surplus food to those in need, thus guaranteeing freedom from want. The white Atua, these strangers who came from beyond all shores, had no place in the order of life. Such was their barbaric state that sorcery did not affect them, or even the power of the priests. So complete was their ignorance that they did not distinguish commoners from chiefs, even as they treated both with murderous disdain. The Spaniards, for their part, were confounded by an island people who appeared both gentle and merciless, often in the same moment. Here were great warriors fully capable of ruthless violence, yet their conflicts were seasonal, preconceived, scheduled, ritualized. A single death could signal the end of battle. The Marquesans had no sense of time, no notion of sin or shame. Their young women flaunted their beauty and were openly sexual, and yet were scandalized and disgusted when the Spaniards relieved themselves in public, as any normal man would do. If sexual licentiousness titillated and confused the Spaniards, cannibalism and human sacrifice horrified them, as did the practice of polyandry and the impossible irrationality of tapu, the indigenous system of magical rules and sanctions that later gave rise to the notion of taboo. Yet other signs of savagery were the glowing blue-black tattoos that covered every part of the Marquesan male body, from the waist to the knees, including the most sensitive surfaces of the genitalia. For the Spaniards, the most perplexing question was how such a primitive people could have accomplished so much. Entire mountainsides and river valleys had been domesticated with monumental stone terraces, irrigation canals, and massive platforms where thousands could gather for ceremonial events, the feasts and celebrations that marked the end of war or the accession of a chief. At such moments, a priest would recite the entire mythological history of the world, hundreds of lines of sacred verse held in the memory of a single man. If he faltered or stumbled on a single phrase, he would be obliged to begin anew. For the words define the contours of history, even as they anticipated the promise of the future. Around the platforms stretched emerald fields of taro and yams, pandanus and coconut. The tree of life was breadfruit, and in the cool earth, the Marquesans built massive stone pits where literally tons of the starchy food could be stored in anaerobic conditions, an 8 months' supply held in reserve at all times so that the people might survive even the most terrifying and destructive of typhoons. Pedro Fernandez de Guerreros, second in command of the Spanish expedition, concluded that the natives he and his comrades met on the beach could not possibly have been responsible for the civilization so indelibly etched upon the land. He noted how the local women swam around the Spanish ships like fish because they were forbidden by tapu from using canoes. How could a culture that had no means of transporting its women settle a string of islands 3 months distant from the nearest outpost of the Spanish realm? How could men, without benefit of a magnetic compass, which he noted they lacked, have sailed to these islands? Conflating myth with geography, he concluded that the Marquesas were in fact an outpost of a great southern continent, and that the people had been transported to the islands by an ancient civilization still waiting to be discovered. Thus, within a month of making landfall, the Spaniards sailed on into the Pacific, searching for this legendary land, a futile quest that would consume the rest of Guerreros' life. Now, Guerreros was not the last sailor to be misled and confounded by the enigma of Polynesia. At a time when European transports, lacking navigational instruments to measure longitude, hugged the coastlines of continents for fear of the open ocean, accounts trickled back to Paris and Amsterdam of fleets of curious vessels plying the open waters of the Pacific. In 1616, a Dutch naval vessel sailing between Tonga and Samoa came upon a flotilla of scores of massive seagoing trading canoes. In 1714, when a mansion in London could be fully furnished for £100, the British government, through an act of parliament, offered a prize of £20,000 to anyone who could solve the problem of determining longitude. Until the invention of the chronometer, navigators relied on dead reckoning, which made it hazardous for an ordinary ship to sail beyond sight of land. Yet in the Pacific, something exceptional was going on. Captain James Cook, arguably the finest navigator in the history of the Royal Navy, was the first to pay serious notice. When he landed in Hawaii, his flagship was met by 3,000 native canoes. At Tonga, he observed that local catamarans could cover 3 leagues in the time that his vessel covered 2. He encountered men from the Marquesas who could understand the language of Tahitians, though nearly 1,600 kilometers separated the islands. On his very first voyage in 1769, he met in Tahiti a navigator and priest, Tupaia, who drew a map from memory of every major island group in Polynesia. More than 120 stones were placed in the sand, each a symbol of an island across a span of more than 4,000 kilometers, from the Marquesas in the east to Fiji in the west, a distance equal to the width of the continental United States. Tupaia later sailed with Cook from Tahiti to New Zealand a circuitous journey of some 13,000 kilometers that ranged between 48 degrees south latitude and 4 degrees north. To his utter astonishment, Cook reported, the Polynesian navigator was able to indicate at every single moment of the voyage the precise direction back to his homeland of Tahiti, though he had neither benefit of sextant nor knowledge of charts. Now, Cook and his naturalist, Joseph Banks, who both learned Tahitian, recognized the obvious cultural connections between these distant islands. Linguistic evidence suggested to Banks that the people of the Pacific had originated in the East Indies. And Cook, too, was convinced that the settling of Polynesia had occurred from the West. From Tubaia, he had learned certain secrets of the winds. He had learned how to follow the sun by day and the stars by night. And he was enormously impressed when the navigator described in detail sailing directions from Tahiti to Samoa and Fiji, south to Australia, and east all the way to the Marquesas. But Captain Cook could never quite convince himself that these journeys had been purposeful. He knew the fury of the Pacific, and he had encountered a group of Tahitians who, helpless in the face of a headwind, had drifted hundreds of kilometers off course, only to be marooned for months in the Cook Islands. So thus began a debate that spun over the waters for almost two centuries. Who really were these people? Where had they come from? And how had they reached across an ocean to settle these impossibly remote and isolated islands? As early as 1803, citing the impossibility of sailing east into the prevailing winds, Joaquin Martinez de Zuniga, a Spanish priest stationed in the Philippines, identified South America as a place of Polynesian origins. 3 decades later, John Lang, an influential clergyman in the early days of the Australian colony of New South Wales, first suggested the notion of accidental drift, accepting that the Polynesians had settled the islands from the west, but only by chance, hapless sailors blown off course, fishermen who went out for food only to stumble upon new lands. This notion of serendipitous diffusion defied logic. After all, what fisherman takes to sea his entire domestic toolkit, chickens, pigs, dogs, taro, bananas, yams, not to mention his family? But as an explanation, it had the convenience of acknowledging historical facts while denying the Polynesian people what we now know to have been their greatest achievement. Accidental drift, championed in particular by a New Zealand civil servant, Andrew Sharp, was not finally laid to rest until the early 1970s, when a series of sophisticated computer simulations based on naval hydrological records of wind and currents concluded that out of 16,000 simulated drift voyages from various parts in points of eastern Polynesia, not one of these hypothetical journeys of drift had managed to reach Hawaii. Now, the waters were further muddied, if you will, by two men, both of whom saw the world not as it was, but how they would have liked it to be. Sir Peter Buck was born Te Rangi Hiroa, son of a Maori mother and an Irish father. One of the most prominent Polynesian scholars of the mid-20th century, he headed for many years the Bishop Museum in Honolulu and had, by association, a very influential professorship at Yale. Acutely sensitive to his own mixed racial heritage and keen in the era of Jim Crow to distinguish Polynesians from the Negroid races, he elaborated a theory that the Pacific had been settled from Asia in a wave of deliberate migrations that swept through the islands but completely bypassed Melanesia. Well, if Peter Buck's racial uncertainties distorted his lens on history, a young Norwegian zoologist, Thor Heyerdahl, inverted history itself with the claim, supported by a harrowing journey of some 7,000 kilometers on a balsa raft, that Polynesia had actually been settled from South America. When the raft, the Kon-Tiki, crashed onto a reef in the Tuamotu Islands some 800 kilometers from Tahiti on August 7th, 1947, after a 101-day journey from Peru, a National Geographic hero was born. Heyerdahl was blonde, good-looking, bronzed by the sun, charismatic, and eminently photogenic, the very archetype of the modern adventurer. In making his sensational claim, Thor Heyerdahl ignored the overwhelming body of linguistic, ethnographic, and ethnobotanical evidence, augmented today by genetic and archaeological data, indicating that he was patently wrong. He failed to note that in order to get the Contiki beyond the Humboldt Current off the coast of Peru, he had required the assistance of the Peruvian Navy. He failed to note that there is no evidence whatsoever in the archaeological record of pre-Columbian Peru that sails of the type that he used in the Contiki existed in South America. Indeed, Heyerdahl was so loose with his interpretations and so casual with chronology that his theory, as one scholar has suggested, was equivalent to a modern historian claiming that America was discovered in the last days of the Roman Empire by Henry VIII, who brought a Ford Thunderbird to the benighted Aborigines. But none of this mattered. Heyerdahl's story was a sensation, and his book Contiki went on to sell more than 20 million copies. But for Polynesians, and indeed for serious scholars of Polynesia, Heyerdahl's theory, which denied the culture its greatest achievement, was the ultimate insult. But it inspired two vitally important historic initiatives. First, it forced archaeologists to dig, to seek and find concrete evidence that would allow them to trace the Polynesian diaspora. Second, it led the Hawaiians to sail. The Polynesian Voyaging Society, established in 1973, launched Hokulea on March 8, 1975. What began as a visionary experiment grew over time into a mission to recapture history and reclaim a stolen legacy. The challenge for archaeologists had always been the dearth of physical remains upon which to establish a chronology. Polynesians, technically sophisticated in so many ways, at the time of European contact, did not use pottery. A first breakthrough came in 1952 on New Caledonia in the Coral Sea. There, at a remote site near a beach called Lapita, archaeologists did find pottery, highly distinctive stamped ceramics, identical to shards that had been found 30 years before on Tonga, an island 2,400 kilometers to the east. Subsequent discoveries in New Guinea and Vanuatu, Fiji, and the Solomon Islands left no doubt of the existence of a lost civilization, an ancient cultural sphere that, beginning around 3,500 years ago, had spread from Melanesia east into the Pacific. In one of the great sagas of prehistory, a people known to us as Lapita, named for the original site in New Caledonia, had left their home in the forests of New Guinea and set out to settle a world. Within five centuries, perhaps 20 generations, and sailing against the prevailing winds, they crossed 3,200 kilometers of water to reach not only Fiji, but beyond to Samoa and Tonga. And they made this journey 10 centuries before the birth of Christ. Then, for reasons that remain unknown, the movement rested for nearly 1,000 years. The ceramic tradition was lost, but not syntax and grammar, the meaning of carved stone or the decorated body, the power of the ancestors, the divine origins of the wind. Beginning around 200 BC, a new wave of exploration began, inspired by the direct ancestors of modern Polynesians. From Samoa and Tonga, they sailed east, reaching the Cook Islands, Tahiti, and the Marquesas, a distance of some 4,000 kilometers. Then, after another hiatus of centuries, new discoveries were made. First, Rapa Nui, Easter Island, and then Hawaii, which was settled around 400 years after Christ. The final great phase of the Polynesian diaspora unfolded roughly around the time of the First Crusade, as navigators probed to the south and west, making landfall in Aotearoa, New Zealand, around 1000 AD. 5 centuries before Columbus, the Polynesians had, over the course of only 80 generations, settled virtually every island group in the Pacific. Imagine for a moment what these journeys entailed. The sailors traveled in open catamarans, all built with tools made from coral, stone, and human bone. Their sails were woven from pandanus, the planking sewn together with cordage spun from coconut fiber. Cracks were sealed with breadfruit sap and resin. Exposed to the elements, the sun by day, the cold wind by night, with hunger and thirst as constant companions, these people crossed thousands of kilometers of ocean, discovering hundreds of new lands, some the size of small continents, other mere island atolls with no landmarks taller than a coconut tree.
You're listening to Ideas in Canada on CBC Radio 1, on Sirius Satellite Radio 137 across North America, and around the world on cbc.ca. I'm Paul Kennedy. The great genius of the Polynesian navigators, says Wade Davis, reminds us that there is more than wisdom. There is also scientific knowledge to be gained from the indigenous peoples of the world. From the Chan Center in Vancouver, The Wayfinders, the second of the 2009 CBC Massey Lectures.
While no doubt there were instances of fishermen blown out to sea or stranded by the wind as they sailed offshore in pursuit of schools of pelagic fish, the overwhelming evidence suggests that these voyages were deliberate and purposeful journeys of discovery. But why did they go? I mean, why would anybody risk his or her life to leave a place like Tahiti or Rarotonga to head into the void? Well, prestige, curiosity, a spirit of adventure certainly played a role. To sail off into the rising sun, quite possibly never to be seen again, was an act of incredible courage that brought enormous honor to your clan. Oral tradition suggests that as many as half the expeditions may have ended in disaster, but as failure implied death, those left behind had a vested interest in imagining success. And in their dreams, they envisioned new lands rising out of the sea to greet their departed relatives, men and women who acquired by their very acts the status of gods. As in any culture, there were more mundane motivations. Inheritance in Polynesia was based on primogeniture, and the social structure was fiercely hierarchical. The only way for a second or third son, or the scion of a lowly family or clan, to achieve wealth and status was literally to discover a new world. Ecological imperatives and crises, both natural and man-made, also drove discovery. As Ron Wright, my good friend, remarked in his Massey Lectures a few years ago, the pollen record on Rapa Nui, or Easter Island, suggests that until the arrival of Polynesians, the island was densely covered in subtropical forest. By the time of European contact, the landscape had been completely modified, with many local species driven to extinction and much of the wealth of the soil exhausted. The flightless birds of New Zealand disappeared within a generation of settlement. Polynesians, like all human beings, were fully capable of overexploiting the natural world, and when their populations exceeded the carrying capacity of the land, they had no choice but to move on, and this implied heading out to sea. Whatever the ultimate motivation, the ancient Polynesians sailed, and though many of the voyages were indeed exploratory, and certain remote islands such as Rapa Nui, once settled, may have become over time isolated, these were not all one-way journeys of desperation. To the contrary, all evidence suggests that regular long-distance trade along established routes crisscrossed the ocean. But how did Polynesians do it? They left no written records. Theirs were oral traditions with all knowledge stored in memory, transmitted generation to generation. Indeed, one of the great tragedies of history was the failure of early Europeans, with notable exceptions such as James Cook, to make any effort to study and record, let alone celebrate, this extraordinary repository of seafaring knowledge. I mean, after all, the prestige and authority of the traditional navigators would have been evident to any unbiased observer. They were the cultural pivots of every community. Navigation fundamentally defined the Polynesian identity. That these masters of navigation were ignored, however, was no mere oversight, but an inevitable consequence of the clash of cultures that came with conquest. Contact brought chaos, devastation, and deprivation. The two pillars of Polynesian society, aside from the navigators and wayfinders, were the chief and the priest. The authority of the chief was based on his capacity to control and distribute surplus food. The power of the priest lay in a spiritual capacity to enforce tapu, the sacred rules of the culture. When European diseases swept through the islands, killing up to 85% of the Marquesans within a month of contact, the demographic collapse destroyed the traditional economy, even as it compromised the priests, who had no capacity to sanction foreigners who violated tapu with impunity and by some miracle were immune to pestilence. Missionaries who in considerable numbers crossed the beaches in the wake of sustained contact blamed the people themselves for their misfortunes, even as they dismissed their religious beliefs as crude idolatry. In such an atmosphere, it would have been difficult indeed for Europeans to acknowledge that Polynesians possessed navigational skills that rivaled and surpassed those of their own sailors, especially given that seamanship, particularly in Britain, was the pride of the nation. Possessing those skills, they most assuredly did. To understand the genius of the ancient Polynesians, Nainoa Thompson told me on the deck of the Hokulea as we left Kauai in a fierce rain to round Oahu before heading north from Molokai by night to the open sea. You must begin with the fundamental elements of the Polynesian world: wind, waves, clouds, stars, sun, moon, birds, fish, and water. Bring to these the raw power of empirical observation, of universal human inquiry. The skills of the traditional navigator are really not unlike those of the scientist. One learns through direct experience and through the testing of hypotheses, with information drawn from all branches of the natural sciences: astronomy, animal behavior, meteorology, oceanography. Temper this with a lifelong training of impossibly intense commitment and discipline, all to be rewarded with the highest level of prestige in a culture where status counts for everything. In other words, all the intellectual brilliance of humanity, together with the full potential of human desire and ambition, applied to the challenge of the sea. Nainoa Thompson's teacher for more than 30 years was Mau Pialu, a master navigator from Satawal in the Caroline Islands of Micronesia. Mau grew up on a coral islet that was a third the size of Central Park in New York. His universe was the ocean. His father was a navigator and his grandfather before him. At the age of one, Mau was selected to inherit the ancestral teaching. As part of that training, he was placed as an infant in tidal pools for hours at a time that he might feel and absorb the rhythms of the sea. When, at the age of eight, on his first deep ocean voyage, he became sick from the swells, his teacher's solution was to tie him to a rope and drag him behind the canoe until the nausea passed. As a young man of 14, he tied his testicles to the rigging of the vessel to more carefully sense the movement of the canoe through the water. Mao learned not only to sail, but also to understand the secrets of the big water, both the physics and metaphysics of waves. It was said that he could conjure islands out of the sea just by holding a vision of them in his imagination. In the shadow of Mao's achievements, Nainoa, a young Hawaiian from a disenfranchised noble family whose grandmother had been beaten at mission school for speaking her native language, found hope and aspired to greatness. From Mao, he learned to pay attention to weather, to read the waves, to understand the meaning of stars, as he put it, to plot a chart to an island in his mind. The prevailing trade winds do indeed come out of the east, Nainoa told me, but there is a time each year when the winds reverse and westerly breezes blow across the Pacific. A trough of low pressure forms a corridor running east from northern Australia, the very route along which the Laputa civilization migrated from the Bismarck archipelago into the central Pacific. Similarly, further north, closer to Hawaii, the winds do not consistently and only blow from the east. What's more, as the Hokulea has proven over the course of more than a dozen ocean voyages, it is possible to tack into the wind, even with a fully loaded canoe. The ancient Polynesians, Nainoa added, were not navigators in a modern sense so much as wayfinders. Sailing from Tahiti for Oahu, for example, they did not set course for Pearl Harbor. They set out to find a chain of islands, the Hawaiian archipelago. Moreover, the distances in the Pacific are not as formidable as they appear on a chart. With the exception of the three most distant points of the Polynesian Triangle, Rapa Nui, Hawaii, and New Zealand, no voyage from Melanesia through Polynesia has to traverse more than 500 kilometers of open water, at least as the crow flies. And there is more land than the maps reveal. At sea, one can see roughly 50 kilometers in any direction. Draw a circle with a radius of 50 kilometers around every landfall, and suddenly the ocean shrinks, and the area effectively covered by land increases. Clouds also provide clues to the wayfinder, their shape, color, and place in the sky. Brown clouds bring strong winds, high clouds no winds but lots of rain. Their movements reveal the strength and direction of winds, the stability of the sky, the volatility of storm fronts. There is an entire nomenclature to describe the distinct patterns clouds form when they gather over islands or sweep across the open ocean. Light alone can be read, the rainbow colors at the edge of stars, the way they twinkle and dim with an impending storm, the tone of the sky over an island, always darker than that over the open sea. Red skies at sunrise and sunset indicate humidity in the air. A halo around the moon foreshadows rain, for it is caused by light shining through ice crystals of clouds laden with moisture. The number of stars within the halo anticipates the intensity of the storm. If there are fewer than 10, expect trouble, high winds, torrential rain. If a double halo surrounds the moon, the weather will move in on the wings of a gale. Other signs are found in wildlife and sea marks as opposed to landmarks. A tan shark moving lazily in the sea. A lone bird separated from its flock. Dolphins and porpoises swimming toward sheltered waters herald a storm, while the flight of a frigate bird heading out to sea anticipates calm. Pelagic birds like the albatross lead nowhere, but others, such as petrels and terns, travel fixed distances from their nests, returning every night to land, rising out of the waves at sunset, their flight paths home as precise as compass bearings. A sighting of a white tern indicates that land is within 200 kilometers. The brown tern reaches only out as far as 65 kilometers, the boobies rarely more than 40. Phosphorescence in the debris of plants in the sea, the salinity and taste and temperature of the water, the manner in which a swordfish swims, all these become revelatory in the senses of the navigator. Now, all of this made sense until we rounded the backside of Molokai and in the darkness of night sailed north into the face of a distant storm. As Nainoa told me, it was one thing to know what to look for, these clues and signs and indications. It was quite another to pull it all together and confront, in the moment, the ever-changing power and reality of the sea. The sky was still clear, the ocean black, the heavens dominated by the innumerable silences of the stars. The Hokulea lumbered into the swells, which were moderate, but still strong, enough to heave the deck and obliterate, to my eye at least, any sense of a horizon. The crew worked in two-hour shifts, with everyone taking a turn at the helm, which was not a rudder, but a long steering paddle that took three to handle. Enshrouded by the night, the canoe itself became the needle of a compass that was the sky. Behind us sat the navigator, a young woman named Keulani, Nainoa's protege. She would remain awake for 22 hours a day for the entire voyage, sleeping only for fleeting moments when the mind demanded a rest. Keulani, like Nainoa and all the experienced crew, could name and follow some 220 stars in the night sky. She knew and could track all the constellations, Scorpio and the Southern Cross, Orion, the Pleiades, the North Star. But for her, the most important stars were those low in the sky, the ones that had just risen or were about to set. Any one star is only dependable for a time, for as it arcs through the sky, its bearing changes. But by then, there will be another star breaking the horizon, again on a bearing known to the navigator. Over the course of a night at sea, roughly 12 hours in the tropics, 10 such guiding stars are enough to maintain a course. With the dawn comes the sun, always a critical transition for the navigator. It is a moment to take measure of the sea and sky, study the winds, observe their impacts on the waves. Mao, Nainoa's teacher, had dozens of names just to identify the different widths and colors caused by the path of the sun as its light and shadow rose and moved over water. All of these told him something about the day to come. The stern of the Hokulea is square, which allows a navigator easily to orient to east and west at both sunset and break of day. There are 8 marks incised along the railings on both sides of the vessel, each paired to a single point in the stern, giving bearings in 2 directions, fore and aft, 32 bearings altogether, which correspond to the 32 directional houses of the star compass. The navigator by day conceptually divides the horizon ahead and behind, each into 16 parts, taking as cardinal points the rising and setting of the sun. Thus, by day, he or she replicates the star compass of the night. The metaphor is that the Hokulea never moves. It simply waits, the axis mundi of the world, as the islands rise out of the sea to greet her. Beyond sun and stars is the ocean itself. When clouds or mist obliterate the horizon, the navigator must orient the vessel by the feel of the water, distinguishing waves created by local weather systems, for example, from the swells generated by pressure systems far beyond the horizon. Even more remarkable is a navigator's ability to pull islands out of the sea. The truly great wayfinders, such as Mao, can identify the presence of distant atolls of islands beyond the visible horizon simply by watching the reverberation of waves across the hull of the canoe, knowing full well that every island group in the Pacific has its own refractive pattern that can be read with the same ease with which a forensic scientist would read a fingerprint. Now, all of this, as you can imagine, is extraordinary. Each one of these individual skills and intuitions a sign of a certain brilliance. But as we isolate, deconstruct, even celebrate these specific intellectual and observational gifts, we run the risk of missing the entire point. For the genius of Polynesian navigation lies not in the particular, but in the whole. the manner in which all of these points of information come together in the mind of the wayfinder. It is one thing, for example, to measure the speed of Hokulea with a simple calculation, the time a bit of foam or flotsam or even a bubble takes to pass the known length separating the crossbeams of the canoe. 3 seconds, and the speed will be 8.5 knots. 15 seconds, and the vessel slogs along at 1.5 knots. But it is quite another thing altogether to make these calculations continually, day and night, while also taking measure of the stars breaking the horizon, winds shifting in both speed and direction, swells moving through the canoe, clouds and waves. The science and art of Polynesian navigation is holistic. The navigator must process an endless flow of data, intuitions and insights derived from observation and the dynamic rhythms and interactions of wind, waves, clouds, stars, sun, moon, the flight of birds, a bed of kelp, the glow of phosphorescence on a shallow reef. In short, the constantly changing world of weather and the sea. What is even more astonishing is that the entire science of wayfinding is based on dead reckoning. You only know where you are by knowing where you have been and how you got to where you are. One's position at any one time is determined solely on the basis of distance and direction traveled since leaving the last known point. You don't look up at the stars and know where you are, Nainoa told me. You need to know where you've come from by memorizing from where you sailed. It was the very impossibility of keeping track over a long voyage of every shift in speed, current, and bearing that kept European sailors hugging the coastlines before the problem of longitude was solved with the invention of the chronometer. But this is precisely what the Polynesians managed to do, and all without benefit of the written word. There were no logs, notebooks, or charts, no speedometers, watches, or compasses. Every bit of data, wind, currents, direction, distance, time, acquired over the course of a long deep sea voyage, including the sequence of its acquisition, had to be stored within the memory of one person, the wayfinder. Latitude north and south could always be determined from the stars, but not longitude. Should the navigator lose the position in relationship to the reference course, the vessel would be lost. This is why Keolani, like all wayfinders, did not sleep over the course of our short journey. Navigators do not sleep. They remain monk-like, undisturbed by the crew, with no mundane tasks to perform, sitting alone on a special perch on the stern of the vessel, tracking the journey with their minds. If you can read the ocean, Mao once said to Nainoa, if you can see the island in your mind, you will never get lost. In 1976, on its first deep-sea voyage, the Hokulea, under Mao's guidance, sailed from Hawaii 4,400 kilometers to Tahiti, where it was greeted, quite unexpectedly, by an enormous, jubilant crowd of 16,000. Nothing like this had ever been seen in French Polynesia. The colonial administrators had, as long ago as 1850, formally outlawed every aspect of traditional cultural life, including long-distance oceanic trade between the islands. The Hokulea brought everything back to life, as if the wind itself were whispers coming forward in time. In 1999, having crisscrossed the Pacific from the Marquesas to Aotearoa, the Polynesian Voyaging Society embarked on its most ambitious journey. With Nainoa as navigator, the Hokulea would try to pull Rapa Nui out of the sea. It was a wildly ambitious expedition. The distance from Hawaii to Easter Island is roughly 10,000 kilometers, but the journey implies crossing the doldrums and tacking into the wind for 2,300 kilometers, which effectively doubles the total sailing distance to 20,000 kilometers, and all to make landfall on an island 23 kilometers in diameter, less than a single degree on a compass, had in fact a compass been on board. Food and water rations were cut in half to lighten the load. In dry dock, 4,000 pounds were stripped from the vessel. The crew was the smallest ever to sail the Hokulea. The route went via the Marquesas to Pitcairn Island. From there, they would tack south, pick up the westerly winds, and sail east to north until within a distance from their target, roughly equivalent to the length of the Hawaiian archipelago. Then they would search for the island, sailing back and forth in a grid, careful that on the downwind runs to the west, they would not overshoot and find themselves forced by the winds to sail on for South America. At one point, close to their goal, Nainoa snapped awake in a daze and realized that with the overcast skies and the sea fog, he had no idea where they were. He had lost the continuity of mind and memory essential to survival at sea. He masked his fear from the crew and in despair remembered Mao's words, "Can you see the image of the island in your mind?" He became calm and realized that he had already found the island. It was the Hokulea, and he had everything he needed on board the sacred canoe. Suddenly, the sky brightened, and a beam of warm light appeared on his shoulder. The clouds cleared, and he followed that beam directly to the island of Rapa Nui. I found it an extraordinary experience to sail with Nainoa on the Hokulea, along with the crew of the Polynesian Voyaging Society. As important as Mao was to him as a mentor and guide, Nainoa Thompson has become an icon for an entire generation of young Polynesians, an immensely important cultural figure, publicly more admired than anyone else in Hawaii. There is a strong sense throughout the islands that as long as the Hokulea sails, the culture of the navigators will survive. Nainoa's entire mission in life is to ensure that this happens. He refers to Hokulea as both a sacred canoe and the spaceship of his ancestors. To me, this is a fitting choice of words. Indeed, if you took all of the genius that allowed us to put a man on the moon and applied it to an understanding of the ocean, what you would get is Polynesia. Thank you very much.
From the Chan Center in Vancouver, you've been listening to The Wayfinders, the second of the 2009 CBC Massey Lectures by Wade Davis. The book of the 2009 Massey Lectures is published by House of Anansi Press and is available across Canada. You can purchase The Wayfinders, Why Ancient Wisdom Matters in the Modern World, either as a book or CD by going to the Ideas website, cbc.ca/ideas. Tonight's lecture was recorded in Vancouver by Kathleen Flaherty, with recording engineer Peter Cracknell. The 2009 CBC Massey Lectures were produced for Ideas by Philip Coulter. The CBC Massey Lectures are co-sponsored by CBC Radio, the House of Anansi Press, and Massey College in the University of Toronto. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht. I'm Paul Kennedy. Please stay tuned to CBC Radio 1 and to Sirius Satellite Radio for the hourly news.